Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. As is familiar to every American, these are unusual times. The nation divided, the Capitol was placed under siege, and the first president in history was impeached not once, but twice. We'll discuss this moment in time towards the end of this program. But first, with all that's going on in Washington, we also have business to take care of right here at home. In 2020, California was among 20 states which looked to taxation issues. In two initiatives in November of 2020, the voters took a serious look at at 1978's Proposition 13 and the tax paradigm created thereunder. In the November election, we're having a little bit of technical difficulties here. It'll resume quickly. In the November election, voters rejected Proposition 15 that would have led to a constitutional amendment to require commercial and industrial properties, except those zoned as commercial agriculture. Why that is, I don't know. All but commercial agriculture would have been rezoned and subject to being taxed based on their current market value rather than at their market value at the time Proposition 13 passed. The voters rejected Proposition 15. At the same time, voters narrowly passed Proposition 19, creating a constitutional amendment that broadens the ability of some homeowners to transfer their tax assessments to another residence within the state, while at the same time limits the ability to avoid reassessments for inherited homes, for some. If there's a net increase in revenue, additional revenues or savings are to be allocated to wildfire agencies and to the counties. What are the major changes brought about by the initiative, and how did we get there? What do I need to do to adjust my estate plan? If I make changes to capitalize on a more beneficial property tax assessment, is there a risk to state and or federal income taxes? And as always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-2855. Once again, that's 866-798-2855. As always, our attorney guest cannot give you specific legal advice, as we don't have all the salient facts of your specific legal situation. We're happy to share the legal principles to help guide you in your decision-making. You can contact us with any question of taxation, property taxation, I should say. You're not limited to the point where we may be in our conversation. To guide us through this overview, Ron Peoples is a San Francisco trust and estates attorney, a graduate of UC Hastings School of Law. Ron's practice focuses on helping individuals and families leave lasting legacies through tailored, thoughtful estate plans. Ron regularly works with new families, second marriages, unmarried persons, and members of the LGBTQ community, and is familiar with the planning considerations that are unique to each group. And Ron appears courtesy of the Bar Association of San Francisco Lawyer Referral and Information Service. My next guest really needs no introduction. Carmen Chu is the elected assessor for the City and County of San Francisco. As assessor, she is responsible for preparing fair and correct valuations and carrying out the rules and regulations imposed by property tax laws. Assessor Chu also serves as the president-elect of the California Assessors Association, a statewide nonprofit organization whose purpose is to improve the assessment procedures and assessment laws for the public good. In 2017, she launched the Bay Area's first Family Wealth Forum, an initiative to bridge the resource gap for low-income and monolingual immigrant communities in assessing free, credible financial and estate planning services to over 2,000 residents and their families who have since received one-on-one counseling or have been helped through this program. Assessor Chu, Attorney Peoples, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for having us. We're excited to be here.
Yes, thanks, Jeff, for having me. Excited to be here as well.
You know, to frame our discussions, before we go further, I'd like to talk a bit about the path that got us here. Assessor Chu, could you please tell us in very broad strokes about the property taxes after Proposition 13 passed in 1978?
Sure. And I think maybe just before I jump into that, I think for folks to know, I think a lot of people may not know what an assessor's office does. Just for a little bit of background, there are 58 counties in the state of California, and in each county, there's one elected assessor to carry out the state's property tax laws. And so it's just important to know that when there's a passage in the state's laws on property taxes, it applies to every single county in the state. So not just San Francisco or perhaps Alameda County, but it actually applies across the state. So I think sometimes some of this information might reach people who are listening from other parts of the Bay Area, just so you know that if you live in California, some of these changes are relevant to you. So that's something that's important to know. I think as a whole, we want to make sure people also understand Prop 13. It's really one of the biggest kind of governing pieces of legislation that really impacts property taxes. It was passed back in 1978. And when it was passed, what it really does is that it limits the amount of increase that is allowable for tax purposes for your home. So let me just give you a very quick example. If your home is currently, let's just say the assessed or taxable value is $1 million, what typically happens in every county is that there is a tax rate. It's roughly around 1%. And we multiply your taxable value by that tax rate to get what your annual tax bill is. So when you see that taxable value is limited per Prop 13 to no more than 2% every year, what you see is that people who have owned property for a very long time have a very low taxable value when you compare it with what the market value of their home might be. So I think for many of us, especially those who live in San Francisco and the Bay Area, you've seen housing prices go up quite a lot. It's not necessarily always just going up by 2% or less than that. Sometimes you're seeing it go up by a lot more. And so even though the market may have increased in terms of the value of your home, we're not allowed under Prop 13 to change that taxable value by more than, again, 2% every year. And this is true across the state of California. Every single county follows this. And so, Jeff, you had asked, you know, what's sort of the impetus behind it? So, you know, when Prop 13 passed so many years ago, I think some of the big issues at that time was that people were seeing that the taxable values on their home was really going up high. And I think especially for many people, it sounded like seniors at the time, they were not able to necessarily catch up or keep up with that increase in taxes when, for example, they lived off of a fixed income. And so Prop 13 passed that limited this increase. But what they did was, rather than just limiting to kind of residences or seniors, they threw in every single property into that mix, including commercial property. So whether it's a big downtown high rise or a shopping center or Disneyland, for that matter, any single property in the state of California lives under this Prop 13 law. The state did vote 33 times on potential changes to Prop 13, but actually only 24 passed. And really what passed were mainly exemptions. So basically additional benefits that were given to not increase taxation were the things that did pass. I think you mentioned earlier, Jeff, that there was sort of a big ballot around Prop 15. That one narrowly did not pass, and that one would have completely changed how we treated commercial properties. But what we did see was that Prop 19 did pass. Prop 19 is really meant to close what is called the Lebowski loophole. And so for anybody who may have watched The Big Lebowski some time ago, there's an actor in it named Jeff Bridges. And this kind of legislation came about because what we see is that there was two years ago, there was an LA Times article where they reported that Jeff Bridges paid $5,700 a year in property taxes on his Oceanside Malibu home where his parents bought it back in the 1950s. the actor was not supposedly living in that home, but was renting it out for $15,000 a month. So even though he was paying only taxes of about $6,000 a year in property taxes, he was actually not pay. He was actually renting it out for quite a lot. And so this is called a loophole because in 1986, there was a law that passed called Prop 58, which actually allows children to inherit the low property taxable value of homes when they inherit it. There are limitations to it, of course, but I think what's happened is that over time, again, people who have held property in their households, whether they decide to use it or not in their residences, they ended up really being able to benefit from a low Prop 13 value over time. And then recently, as you know, when Prop 19 got on the ballot, it was actually originally an initiative measure by the Association of Realtors. My understanding was that it was really meant to drive transactions, so they wanted to encourage the sale of properties, essentially. Eventually, that did not go forward, and the state ended up submitting a initiative measure instead, but it was pretty much the same thing. And so, again, it passed with a really narrow margin. I want to say like 400,000 votes across the state of California, like 52 to 48% roughly in terms of the passage. So again, really narrowly passed, and it will change some of the ability to pass on that low Prop 13 value. So quite a lot of information, Jeff, but it's a big change that I think will impact many people who may have already made plans around how they plan to pass on property.
And what I'm getting an echo. What I'm really seeing when I look at the initiative is that really two things changed. One changed who benefits, who could transfer that money that couldn't before, that property. And the other is people that thought they could transfer it that can't anymore. Can you talk a little bit about who won and who lost with this initiative?
Absolutely. And I think your assessment is right. Under Prop 19, there's actually quite a lot of changes within it. There's one part that actually increases benefits, and it increases benefits to seniors, 55 and older, to individuals who are disabled, and for those who may be victims of disasters like wildfires. It allows them to be able to keep or basically carry forward their Prop 13 lower taxable value to a replacement home. It's made that universe of changes or exchanges more permissible. So not only did it expand who was eligible, but it also made it that you can do this three times in your lifetime, whereas in the past it was only one example. However, there are also parts of this legislation that now will restrict some of the benefits, the tax benefits that could pass on from parents to children, for example. So as I mentioned before, there was a program called Proposition 58 that allows a child who inherits a property from a parent, for example, to be able to keep the low Prop 13 value of the parent. So long as it is the primary residence, there's no limit to it, and up to $1 million of assessed value for any other kind of property. So that includes rental properties, and it also includes commercial properties. Under Prop 19, it would change because if the child is inheriting the primary residence, they actually have to live there in order to have the benefit. So in the past, you didn't have to necessarily live there so long as you inherited. But now, if you want to get that tax break or that tax benefit, you're going to actually have to live in the home that you inherit, that primary residence. And then as for any other property, so any rental properties that might exist, so a second home that you might be renting out or potentially commercial property, none of that would be eligible to have a tax benefit any longer. And so I think this is a big thing because many people might have established trusts or have made some plans for the future about, this law, what they thought was existing, which was a Prop 58, thinking that that would be kind of the rule when they passed on the property. And in fact, that is changing. I will say that it's important for people to know that the two pieces of the law that you rightly pointed out, they go into effect on different days. So in terms of the benefits restricting from the parent to child transfers, that actually would go into effect in February, mid-February, so relatively quickly. And then the senior disabled individuals and victims of disasters portion would go into effect in April. So two different effective dates for two very different changes.
Let me bring Ron Peoples into the conversation as well. How do we adjust for this? We want to be able to transfer the property. Should I just take my kids and put them on the deed now?
That's a great question, and I think that's a question a lot of people have. Is and I think lifetime transfers are going to be something people are looking at, and there is and always have been some benefits to coming up with a strategy to transfer property during lifetime. Everything from getting that property out of the donor, the person gifting it, out of that person's estate for estate tax purposes, and now potentially to preserve property taxes so that the children, when they inherit it, don't have an increased tax bill. So I think there are going to be a lot of people who benefit from having the conversation and understanding whether a transfer is a good fit, because there are factors you weigh in that decision.
So I'd like to open it up to both of you, both of my guests, for the next few questions. But what I really want to know is, what are the questions that you're getting now since the passage of Proposition 19? What are people calling and asking?
Yeah, so we're getting quite a lot of questions. I think the number one, people want to know when it's going to go into effect, and they also want to know what they should do if they've created a trust. I think one of the things that most worry me is that there are many people who have created, say, revocable trusts, which is really helpful for them to bypass probate, but they think that this law won't apply to them because they simply have created the trust. And I want to just say that that is not true, that the trust, the creation of a revocable trust, for example, may not necessarily, because you haven't exchanged or you haven't really truly transferred property, it doesn't keep Prop 19 from impacting you should a transfer date happen after it goes into effect. So I think just the one big thing that I want to put out there is that there are many people who have already created trusts thinking that simply the act of creating the trust absolves them of having Prop 19 apply to them. That is not the case. So it's really important for you to take a look at what you've done within your trust and to think through kind of how you may want to pass on your property, if it's now or later. I think Ron was saying earlier that there are many questions that are coming up, and there are considerations. We're only speaking about one part. We're just talking about property taxes right now and the impact on Prop 19 to property taxes, but there are a lot of other taxes that might impact you, whether we're talking about estate or gift taxes in the future, or we're talking about capital gains taxes that could also impact people. How you transfer it and when you transfer it have implication for all of those other things as well.
And I understand, Assessor Chu, that you have to leave and you can't stay with us for the duration. I wanted to give you a chance for anything you wanted to say in closing and anything you want to share with us before you have to leave.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, Jeff, for inviting us to speak. I think the one thing is that there is going to be a big rush of people who may want to record a transfer or a change in their property right now to try to take advantage of the existing program. Before you do that, I definitely suggest you really think through what all of those implications are. And then just also know that once you transfer property, whether it's through an irrevocable trust or otherwise, remember that you're giving up property ownership and the legal rights to your property. So it's really important, because I've heard many people who say, you know, I've passed it on to my children and now they want me to leave the house. Well, that's a real possibility because you no longer own that home, right? So I just want to make sure that people think through what that could mean for them. The other thing is that because so many recordings are going to happen, I want people to know that our office is open. I know under COVID-19, that might be something that people worry about. How do we get access to recording our documents with your office? Just know that we have information on our website, sfassessor.org. And then really the biggest ways that you can do it, you can mail it in directly to us, but you can also drop it off at a drop box located at City Hall on the Grove Street side. So we definitely have that available for folks so that we can continue to record your documents and make sure that you transfer it in the time that you want. Thank you, Jeff.
Assessor Chu, before you, are you still there before you hop off where I can just do one? Okay. One quick follow-up to that. I know is a lot of questions I get from clients is, to the extent that they do decide to move forward with some type of transfer strategy or transfer sequence, and they are able to execute those documents right now under these laws. But let's say, for example, they get to the mail and they don't quite get recorded before the date. I don't know if we have any guidance yet. My understanding would be that so long as the documents are all effective prior to the date, if the recorder, for example, or the assessor's office, takes beyond the date to record them, that they would still be recorded under the prior rules. I don't know if you have any guidance or thoughts on that or can say anything now. And that's
fine. So we are working through with our city attorneys on this. And so here's the thing is that the law passed in November. It was just certified in December, and it's going into effect in February. And we still have a whole lot of information we're trying to get guidance from the State Board of Equalization, as well as the legislators for enabling legislation. I think it gets complicated, Ron, because there are multiple ways that transfer of property can happen. And so for example, in some instances, let's just say that a trust was created some time ago, and the transfer is happening because of a death, right? Well, we would be taking a look at the date of death, potentially, for the effective transfer date. And then that would be kind of the guiding date that we would utilize to figure out which law applies, right? Versus there are sometimes people who are executing transfers through recording a new grant deed with our office or other mechanisms. And so we don't want to be the any bottlenecks. If we get like a huge rush of documents, we don't want to be the reason why you don't qualify for a previous program. So we are working with all of our attorneys right now, but I just definitely recommend if people are going to, and are even thinking about transferring property, that they need to record a deed. Make sure that if you're recording documents, you're getting them notarized and dated, of course, in having that clear documentation of when that occurred. And then making sure that you give time to record with our office. If you're at all able to do a Dropbox drop-off, that is much better than going through mail, because mail takes a period of time for processing and so on. So we just want to make sure that we have plenty of time to make sure that we have all the documentation we need to process it as well. There are times when we have to reject documents and send it back to you. And my worry is that if that happens and there's not enough of time for it to get back to you and for you to re-record, then that's an issue. So please, please, please do it early, plan ahead, and give plenty of time for the right documentation to get done. So thank you for that question, Ron.
Thank you for the answer.
And thank you very much for answering our questions, for joining us, for explaining to us this new paradigm. And we look forward to having you back in the future.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're taking a serious look at Proposition 19, explaining how it changed the paradigm governing property taxes and what you need to do to adjust. Joining me tonight were Carmen Chu, the elected assessor for the City and County of San Francisco, and San Francisco Trust and Estates Attorney Ron Peoples. If you have questions for my guest, what does this mean? What do I do now? Where do I go? Our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. Tonight, we're talking about property taxation and Proposition 19. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. Ron, what I wanted to hit you up is really to hear the questions people have been bombarding you with since this proposition passed. We talked a little bit about it with Assessor Chu, and that question that came up really was, how do I know when do I want to transfer my property to my kids? Or maybe I don't. From the perspective of estate planning, can you give us some guidance?
Yeah. So as Assessor Chu was saying, part of this is there are many unknowns. So what we're working with is what we know now. And what we do know now is that post February 16th, 2021, so a little over a month, transfers between parents and children are going to be different. And how is that? Well, more are going to be reassessed, meaning that more children who stand to inherit property from their parents stand to have an increase in their property tax bill if they don't take advantage of current laws or use one of the mitigating strategies that estate practitioners are working with their clients quickly on to develop. And so the question I get often is, my mom has a house that she bought in the 70s in the Sunset, and there's my sibling and I are going to be the ones who inherit that property. What do we do? She has a revocable trust right now. We are the beneficiaries. What do we do, right? And that question is common among a lot of people in the Bay Area because as Assessor Chu mentioned, in this area, many of those properties purchased by the generation before the children have appreciated a lot in value. And so to give you an example, in the Sunset, for example, in the 80s, 70s, and 80s, I have clients who purchased their home for $10,000 to $20,000. And so as Assessor Chu explained, the property taxes for those homes purchased in the 70s and 80s is based on what the assessed value of the home was in that year. Those property taxes tend to be extremely low. What happens, though, is now that the property's appreciated, that same property in the Sunset, you could be looking at $2 to $3 million as in fair market value. So the difference in property taxes, if the county took a look at it now, that same property, and increased based on today's values, would be huge. And while Assessor Chu mentioned that some people are receiving very high rents for properties, and that was maybe some of the push to increase property taxes, the reality is that a lot of people aren't, and we're in a situation now where we have rent control, and it could be that that property that stands to have an increase in property taxes has low-paying rent-controlled tenants in it. And what does that do? Well, that means that the children who stand to inherit that property, to the extent that they want to continue to use it as a rental, could quickly see the profits that they had eaten up in additional property taxes if the property is reassessed. So when we go back to that question, what do we do? Mom has a home, we stand to inherit it. The next question is typically, what does the family want to do with the home? And that driving force is going to help place us in that realm of, okay, what are the competing interests and which one prevails? And those competing interests are what Carmen Chu explained. There are estate and gift tax interests, there are consequences to transfers, there are capital gains implications for income tax on the federal level with transfers, and then there are property taxes. And so determining what the intent with the property is helps practitioners guide clients in whether they should or should not be looking at lifetime transfers. And does that make sense on a broad strokes before I move on to the next
section? In a broad strokes, it makes sense.
So then the real answer is, if you intend to keep the property, if the kids want to keep the property and keep it as a rental, then one of the primary goals is to keep the property taxes down. And for those people, it is extremely important that they speak to an estate planning attorney now, like tomorrow. And in fact, I think many attorneys are not able to keep taking on these questions because they do apply to so many people. So the sooner you seek it out, the better. But essentially what you want someone to do is help both the donor, the person who would be giving the property, understand what that means and what it would help or not help with in terms of the beneficiaries. So if they want to keep a low property tax bill, keep the parents' property tax bill, the kids, that being when they inherit it, and mom or dad wants to help out with that, or mom or dad or whoever it is, then we may look at some lifetime gifting structures to lock in today's rules so we can transfer the property to the children without a property tax increase. And then we'll pair it, though, with a few items that Carmen Chu didn't mention, which is something to help the donor preserve their rights. So if you are a parent and you have a home, you may not want to lose control over that home and gift it to your child right now or complete control. So we would definitely be looking at mitigating mechanisms such as co-ownership agreements, to make sure that parents who are wanting to do these type of transfers and the kids who are going to be involved in them, all parties can understand their rights and responsibilities with regard to the transfer. So even if we say, look, you're in a situation where you would greatly benefit from transferring this property during your lifetime to the parent or the donor, and the kids would benefit from it for what they expect to do with the property, meaning they want to keep it as a rental, we still want to make sure we delineate who has rights and responsibility, where does income go, who gets to live there. All of those things that Assessor Chu mentioned could be problematic for lifetime gifting.
Let me interrupt you there. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights here on KALW San Francisco at 91.7 FM and online at kalw.org. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Associations of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. To call, 415-989-1616. Once again, that phone number is 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. Stick around at 7 o'clock, we'll have Rose Aguilar for your call live here on KALW San Francisco.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight we're talking about property taxes, Proposition 19, how it's changed the paradigm governing property taxes. And for the next 10 minutes or so, what we're really focusing on, what you do or don't want to do to adjust. My guest at this point is Trusted Estates Attorney Ron Peoples. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You have about 10 minutes to call in, and as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking property taxes, or maybe a little broader look at taxes. You're not limited to the exact point we are in our conversation. And Ron, we talked about control of properties. We didn't talk much about the big problem, the big thing in the room that we have to talk about, which is the IRS, whether state or federal income taxes might be implicated by what we're doing here. I want to talk about how those two things play against each other and give our viewers some idea where this takes us.
Absolutely. So as we mentioned earlier, property tax is just but one prong in the analysis. And so another prong is federal income tax or income tax in general. Capital gains taxes is what we're talking about essentially here. And why are they implicated? Well, whether you gift a piece of property during lifetime or on death will have different implications on the capital gains exposure to the beneficiaries under the current law. And I say that with a big caveat under the current law, because there are a lot of proposed changes to the tax law by Biden's administration. We have no idea what will or won't pass, but we do know the step up in basis, which I'm about to get into, is one thing that is potentially being looked at as being repealed under Biden's administration. So all of this is to say that this is a very current conversation, and you definitely need to stay in touch with what's going on with the tax laws as they change, as we switch administrations. With that caveat, I'll go into it. So
before you do, let me turn it over. We've got a caller coming in. Let me turn it over to Stephanie in Menlo Park. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
I'm sorry, I just joined your show on Prop 19, and my question is, we have one son and two properties, so, you know, he can't live in both. I'm wondering if we add his name to the ownership title, which is held in trust for both of us, would that trigger a Prop 13 change in the valuation of a property, adding him to our trust ownership?
Well, good. I'm glad you asked this question, because I think it was, I was going towards one part of the answer at least before. So let's take a step back. You've got one son and you've got two properties. And your question is, do you transfer one or both properties to your child now? And what are the implications of that? Is that correct? Do I understand your question?
Actually, even more to the point of my question is, if we add him to the ownership of the property, which is in the name of the trust for both of us, would that trigger a reassessment of our properties?
So you could add him to the title or to the ownership of the property, right? And you wouldn't necessarily add him as an owner to your trust. And we can talk more about that on another topic or another night. But yes, you could add him as an owner to the property. You would, if you did it before February 16th and got your change of ownership reported with the county, then you would be under the purview of existing law. And that means that you can transfer an unlimited amount of assessed value from a parent to a child for a primary residence and up to $1 million of assessed value for a non-primary residence property, like that secondary property you own. And if you did it prior to February 16th and got it recorded, then you would be under current law and you would have no reassessment, meaning that the property taxes would remain intact so long as you met those prongs. Number one, either it be a primary residence, or number two, the non-primary residents have less than $1 million in assessed value that you would be transferring to your child. And that second prong of the non-primary residence property, that is exactly what Proposition 19 eliminates. So post February 16th, you wouldn't be able to transfer that non-primary residence property to your child without a reassessment occurring. And so that property is ripe for you to speak with a practitioner and get a consultation where that practitioner can go through all of the facts with you and the pros and the cons. And what are those pros and the cons? Well, the con is, or the considerations are, if you did transfer a property to your child right now before the effective date of Proposition 19, it would have federal tax implications if your child later decided to sell that property. And now that speaks to the capital gains analysis we were just about to go into. And so the real question for your child is, what do they intend to do with the property? If your child says, when I inherit that property, I'm going to sell it no matter what, and I'm sure of that. Well, in that sense, then under the current law, it may be better for your child to inherit that property because they get what's referred to as a step up in basis on your death. And I'm going to give a very simplistic overview of what that means. But essentially what it is if somebody dies, everything that person owns gets a new tax basis to fair market value on their death. And that's important for capital gains purposes because capital gains are calculated by taking the difference between the sale price and the individual's basis. So if your son inherited the property, he'd get a new basis of fair market value on the date he inherited it. If he sold it for fair market value, the difference between the sell price of fair market value and his basis of fair market value is zero. He has zero taxable income. So if you take that non-primary residence property and you let him inherit it and he intends to sell it, it's going to be better for him from a capital gains perspective. If you gift it, but it may be not from a property tax perspective because now it's likely to be reassessed. And so that is essentially the analysis we'd help you work through. And that's not really something we can do over the phone right here, but those are the points that your practitioner should talk through with you and look at the facts specific to your property to give you advice on each one and what your son would be looking at depending on what the intent is.
So let me tighten it up, Stephanie, and just point out, complex situation, you really need some advice for somebody that can look at the values in your particular case, when you purchased it, what the plans are to do with it to really help make that decision so they can balance out those two factors. And that's when you want to get some professional advice, probably from an attorney and or a tax preparer, probably both, before making any decisions. And time is tight. But thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights.
Okay. Did you or will you be providing further contact for professionals in this area?
One place you can call for professionals in this area is the Lawyer Referral Service. You're in Menlo Park. I would call the Lawyer Referral Service of the San Mateo County Bar Association. You can reach them at SMCBA, as in San Mateo County Bar Association, smcba.org. You can self-refer to somebody, or alternatively, you can call them at 650-369-4149.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Let me turn it to George in San Francisco. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Hey, can you hear me okay?
We can, but we have to move along pretty quickly. We've got about...
Wonderful. I'll try and move fast. I so much appreciate this episode. I'm going to download it and listen to it 10 times and try and get my mind wrapped around everything. I'm going to give you I'm in an old school San Francisco situation in that, you know, my parents bought their home in the 70s. For, you know, 60, 70 grand, and it's a two-unit, two-family building where the Victorian is. They live upstairs. The tenants live downstairs. And my understanding or my sort of thing, I was always assuming that once they passed, I would move upstairs and continue to use the downstairs rental unit as income. And I'm curious what happens after February 14, 15, 16. You know, if that happens and my parents pass after Prop 19 is in place and I move in upstairs, does my property then get reassessed to current market value? Even if I move in upstairs and the downstairs unit, you know, is occupied by the same tenants or new tenants or whatever it is.
So the short answer, to sum up, the question is, when you have a mixed-use property like this, where you have a parent-to-child transfer, the child receiving is still planning on living on the property, but you also have a rental unit and the same premises. Will he be in the same dilemma that you just described, or will there be a specific provision for this, Ron?
The short answer is we're not certain right now. So the State Board of Equalization is yet to issue regulations that would clarify some of those points. Some of them are how many children need to move in if more than one inherits it, or some of these mixed use issues. But essentially, from what we know, if it happens post the effective date of Proposition 19, if your property has more than $1 million in appreciation in it, which it probably does at this point, then... Right. If you move into it as your principal residence and you qualify under the Prop 19 rules, so you got everything good there, and it was a homestead was elected by your parents, so it's a primary residence now. You meet the primary residence prong, you move in within 1 year and declare it with the county. Then essentially the calculation would be the fair market value of the property at that time minus $1 million of assessed value equals the amount of tax of assessed value that's subject to property taxes. So if that property is worth $3 million now, you would subtract $1 million from it and have about $2 million that would be multiplied by the applicable tax rate. So it is going to go up a lot unless you do some type of transfers prior to the effective date of Prop 19.
Once again, a complex situation. You'll get better answers by spending some time with the appropriate professionals rather than the brief time that we have here, but you get a sense of how it works.
Understood, and I very much appreciate it. And I think there are many people in San Francisco who are in two-family Victorians because that's kind of the heart and soul of San Francisco architecture. So
that it is.
I very much appreciate the episode, and I very much appreciate the advice. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. We have but a minute or so for each, but we do have two more calls. Can we turn to Cecilia in San Francisco? Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, thank you. I have a revocable trust in which my daughter is the inheritor, and it's already been established that she will be the owner of the home. Now, is this Prop 19 going to affect that? I bought the property in 98 for around $300, and it is now assessed at a little over $1 million. Does that have anything to do with her capital gains or anything?
So the short answer is the numbers should be run by your practitioner or by your accountant, as Jeff's said a few times, and I don't have the math capabilities in my head to confidently do it for you now. But the question is what your daughter intends to do with the property, right?
And so exactly, yes, and I don't know that at this point. So
it could, you know, and it could be, but, it could be a situation where there might be advantages for you in looking at doing some transfers before Proposition 19 takes effect and maybe not. I would start by having a conversation with your daughter and then probably scheduling a consultation after that point to speak with a practitioner once you know what she intends, and you guys can make an informed decision.
Okay, now if she intended to rent it, then that would be her income, correct?
If she intends to hold the property for a period of time after your passing, then it's more of a reason why you would want to speak with an attorney to make sure that if there is a way to mitigate the effects of Proposition 19 for her, that you do look into that.
Okay, and now, I'm sorry, I tuned in late. What exactly is Prop 19, just quickly?
Proposition 19, to give you a real quick summary, it changed who benefits by Proposition 13 when you're passing property from parent to child, or people that are over 55 or perhaps the victim of a disaster can transfer the property without increasing the basis. There are winners, there are losers under Proposition 19. It's a little more than we have time to go into right now as we're running out of time for this segment. But if you listen to the beginning of our show at KALW.org, you can play it back within about 20 minutes. At that time, you can actually hear it and hear the description in greater detail.
Okay, fine. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Okay.
And unfortunately, Bill, we have but a minute. Can you make a very quick question and can we grab a real quick answer?
Yes, thank you. My sole heir in my revocable living trust is not my child or any other relative. She is a friend. Does that affect whether or not I can transfer ownership to her before February 16th?
No, Proposition, not in this, under this set of facts you just gave, we're not as worried about Proposition 19, which in the cases we've been talking about deals more with the limitation to parent-to-child exclusions and with victims of wildfires or seniors who are looking for replacement properties because it's a friend. It shouldn't apply here.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. I'd also like to thank Ron Peoples for joining us. We have run out of time for this segment, but I would like to invite you back anytime. This is Ron Peoples, trust and estate planning attorney out of San Francisco. Ron@peopleslaw.com, if I got that correct.
Ron@legalpeoples.com. And it's www.legalpeoples. If you go to my website, all my info's there.
And thank you for joining us. I'm going to turn it over to, in our last segment. You know, we realize this is a very stressful and unusual time in history. And to talk a little bit about the stressors in the moment, both in Washington and at home, tonight I'm joined by two guests who should by now be known to listeners of Your Legal Rights, political analyst Dean Johnson and Jamal Anderson, who lived in Washington, D.C. and worked on Capitol Hill. To both of you, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, nice to be here, Jeff.
Good to be here, Jeff.
In the little bit of time that we've got going, I wanted to talk about a few things. Jamal, I would just like to hear from you more than we've heard from all kinds of analysts and pundits that are looking from 10,000 feet. But as somebody who's really been boots on the ground in that area, you lived in D.C. for a considerable amount of time. You were an aide assisting on Capitol Hill as well as in local politics in Washington. I really wanted to get from you what you're feeling when you watch this stuff. How out of the usual norm is what we're seeing?
Well, Jeff, I have to say that when I saw the events of last Wednesday, it was surreal. As you indicated, I worked on Capitol Hill for three members of Congress, including the Speaker. I'm very familiar with the office Capitol complex, as well as the specific offices and office buildings. And to see the desecration of the Capitol, the manner in which the rioters destroyed property, entered specific office space, some of which I've been in myself, it was really hard to watch. It was both sad and outrageous, and I feel so very much for the members of Congress, but also specifically as a former staffer, for the staff members who were subject to the conduct of these insurrectionists. It's hard to imagine that something like this could happen, but this is unfortunately where we are.
Dean, as a political analyst, I'd like to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the strategizing that's going on behind the scenes and the future of the Republican Party.
Well, you know, the quote that's been going through my mind all week is the opening line from A Tale of Two Cities. These are the best of times and these are the worst of times. They're the worst of times, obviously, because we all had to sit through the horror show of a coup d'etat in our attempted coup d'etat in our own home country. And it's the second such attempt I've sat through. The last one was in a real live banana republic, and I never thought I would see it in my own home. But it's the best of times, I think, because we're getting an education in politics as it really is in most of the world most of the time. And politics, as I often tell my students, is a ruthless strategic game that's played with one goal, which is to stay in power as long as possible. That's the game that Donald Trump played. And right now, the name of the game is, how does the Republican Party survive? and you see people like Mitch McConnell and the other leaders of the Republican Party struggling to game out exactly what they're going to do now, because they're on the horns of a dilemma. They have a choice. They can either revert to the mean, they can go back to the traditional Republican Party of mostly white, mostly male, mostly rich pillars of the community, or they can embrace the populism and of Donald Trump. None of those solutions are good for them. If they go back to the mean, if they go back to the old days of a relatively colorless Republican Party, they're stuck with ideas that have been discredited since the Hoover administration. They need to find some entirely new paradigms for politics and economics in order to attract anyone's attention. On the other hand, if they embrace Trump and Trumpianism, then they become the party of a twice impeached president, and they bring along the baggage of white supremacy, xenophobia, racism, and conspiracy theories. So the solution is really not good.
I'd like to give you...
Yeah, what we see now is Mitch McConnell trying to figure out what to do about that and how to game that out. And we're hearing rumors that the decision has been to try to purge Donald Trump from the Republican Party and hope that he doesn't in some way make a comeback.
I really see two things that I'd like you both to have a chance to comment on. One of them is, having studied a bit of history, I'm drawn to the election period surrounding 1854, that's 6 years before Abraham Lincoln was elected and before we launched into Civil War. And we had a similar episode with the Whigs. And it seems like the Republican Party, to a point, is following in that same posture, which led to the Whigs dissolving. And actually, that's what created the vacuum where the Republicans came in the first place. But the other thing I'm seeing is, taking it a step from what you just said, Dean, it seems that Donald Trump was following exactly that level of brinksmanship, but didn't know when the time came he should have gotten off the ride. Then you've got a bunch of more congresspersons than senators, but a whole lot of people in the Republican Party that didn't know how to, at that point, distance themselves and get off the ride. And they rode it even farther. That's my view from 20,000 feet. I'd like to hear from both of you with a bit more of a sense of what's going on in politics. How do they recover from this?
Well,
Jamal, do you have a sense?
Let me say, Dean mentioned the baggage of Donald Trump, which frankly, from my perspective, is not going anywhere. We may on January 20th rid ourselves of Trump, but it does not appear that we are going to rid ourselves of Trumpism. And I point to the 197 members of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives, who today voted against the single article of impeachment relative to incitement of insurrection. And one might ask, if you're not willing to vote to an impeachment president based on the type of behavior that we saw last Wednesday, when would you be able to do that?
I could easily interject and say, that's a real easy question. That conduct committed by someone from the opposite party.
Well, potentially. I think that the fundamental point is that Donald Trump will no longer be president in a week, but we will still have the members of the Republican Party who last week voted in opposition to certifying electoral results in a number of states, and who again today voted in opposition to impeachment because of their loyalty to Donald Trump and because in some respects of their fear of the base that voted them into office. And so this is going to be a lengthy process for the country to come to terms with what the Republican Party has become, and whether or not that results in a different party or not is to be determined. But this is not something that is going to be resolved following a conviction of the president in the Senate or an acquittal.
You know, one of the things that comes to mind, you brought up his base, and that's really the largest problem that we face right now, is that for the last several years, President Trump and several before him that really helped pave the way for him to be there really empowered a base that's rather frightening. And those people are empowered. Those people think they're fighting for their freedoms and for democracy to the exclusion of people that don't look like they do. What's going to happen in a week?
Well, if I can just respond to your original question, you know, I think 1854 is a partial analogy. The Whigs were a dying party. Like the Republicans now, they didn't have any fresh ideas. They didn't have any solutions to the main problem of the day, which was slavery. The Republican Party was formed, and it did have some ideas. And it also had some very charismatic politicians, most notably Abraham Lincoln. But I've been studying a different part of history. I've been looking at the history of authoritarian movements like the one that's being led by Donald Trump. And I think the one thing we need to do is not be overconfident about Donald Trump and his followers and the people who invaded the Capitol disappearing. In 1923, Adolf Hitler led an attempted coup in Germany. He was arrested, tried and convicted of treason, and spent a year in prison. 8 years later, he was elected Chancellor of Germany, and a year after that, he became absolute dictator of Germany, and the rest is history. These people don't tend to go away. They're deeply entrenched. There were 70 million people that voted for Donald Trump. More people than voted for him in 2016. And those people are still there. And whether we're going to be able to attract them away from the extreme, because they've been systematically radicalized over the last decade by media, by foreign influence, by social media, and by Donald Trump, whether we can attract them back into the mainstream is our big problem. And we're going to have to come up with some very good ideas and some very good politicians who will be able to do that, if it's going to be done at all.
Jamal, do you agree? Are we in that dire straits?
I do agree. And I think, you know, just as COVID rendered the invisible visible relative to many of the ills faced by so many Americans, this episode last Wednesday, and in fact, the Trump presidency, has rendered visible so many issues, not the least of which, for example, are the inequities in policing and the hypocrisy that was exposed last week by virtue of how police interacted with the rioters and insurrectionists versus how they prepared, for example, to interact with Black Lives Matter protesters. And so we have a long road ahead of us. Certainly unity is possible, but before there is any unity, there needs to be some accountability. And I think the impeachment today was the first step in that direction.
Well, we're essentially out of time, but I'd like to thank you both for joining us, especially on short notice. You've been listening to your
pleasure as always, Jeff. Thanks.
Good to be here. Thank you.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights. In our first segment, we took a look at Proposition 19, where our guests have been Carmen Chu, the elected assessor for the City and County of San Francisco, and San Francisco Trust and Estates Attorney Ron Peoples. We then ended the program with a look at where we are this moment in Washington and at home with Dean Johnson and Jamal Anderson. I'd like to thank all of our guests for joining us tonight. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 p.m., where we will continue our discussion of common trust and estates issues. Once again, thanks to all of our distinguished guests, Ron Peoples, Jamal Anderson, Dean Johnson, and Assessor Cameron Chu. And thanks to all of you for joining us. And at the controls, to Damian D. Major, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights here on KLW San Francisco, and support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. To call, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org.